What Keeps You Up at Night, Season 2, The Night I Didn't Sleep.
J'invite maintenant la COP à adopter le projet de décision intitulé Accord de Paris qui figure dans le document. Je regarde la salle, je n'entends pas d'objection. L'accord de Paris pour le climat est accepté.
December 12, 2015. Laurent Fabius, president of the COP21, strikes his small hammer down and announces the official adoption of the Paris Agreement. 196 delegations spent 2 weeks working on it. But how did they pull it off? To find out, our team of three did a little reporting trip to Le Bourget, where it all took place.
Le Bourget.
And so this is where it's supposed to all have happened? COP21? Really?
Yeah, Le Bourget. We're surrounded by trucks as we're walking to the conference center where COP happened. And I don't know if you guys think the same, but it smells like smog here.
Yeah, it's pollution. My nose is itchy.
Then again, maybe the highway next to them was a little reminder of what they had to decide on, the planet's future, limiting greenhouse gas emissions.
I think it's hard to imagine this is where it all took place. It's a bit underwhelming, to be honest. There's nothing that screams saving the planet here. It's a big empty lot that looks to be going under construction. There's a huge hangar, but it seems to be empty also. The only sign we saw was one about the Air and Space Museum.
Oh, look, there's a statue in the middle of a roundabout.
Will it be about COP21? Suspense, oh, we'll find out soon.
Let's see. Oh, wow.
No plate to remind us that this is where it all happened. The only commemoration plate we see is one of Charles Lindbergh, who was a pilot, and I think he's the first guy who managed to fly over the Atlantic.
It's quite ironic when you know that the space and air industry is one of the most polluting in the world.
And yet, this is where the Paris Agreement was written.
When you think about the 21st UN Climate Summit, imagine a game of chess, with thousands of players, each playing on multiple boards, all at the same time. 196 delegations moving their pieces according to their interest while the clock is ticking. A diplomatic marathon of 2 whole weeks. After the failure of the previous climate summits, negotiators had an urgent agenda: writing an international agreement to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius, even if participants had to pull all-nighters when time was running out. So what was the perfect play for a checkmate against climate change? Welcome to the COP21, featuring sleepless nights, errors and typos due to exhaustion, and the unbearable reality of the planet's future stuck in the hands of thousands of negotiators.
Setting up the COP21 chessboard.
November 30th, 2015. The launch of COP21 makes headlines across the world.
The COP21 climate summit.
La COP21.
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 And so we look to this current COP21 conference in Paris and ask, can a miracle deal be reached? And who's going to pay for it?
2 weeks before the opening of COP, terrorist attacks in Paris killed 130 people and injured hundreds more, triggering worries that the French government and the United Nations might cancel the climate summit. But the organizers ramped up security, and Le Bourget Conference Center, located in a Paris suburb, was finally deemed fit to welcome 196 delegations from all corners of the world.
You have to represent yourself with a mere city that we had to build within 2 or 3 months.
Alexandre Ziegler is chief of staff to French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius, who also presides over COP21. he'll end up spending the 2 weeks of COP21 in the noisy bubble where negotiations are taking place.
I think we were like 4,000 people, including 2,000 negotiators within the conference premises itself. We were 196 parties at that time. Each delegation has its own offices. You had a lot of conference rooms to accommodate all the negotiators, but also smaller rooms for more secret or bilateral negotiations. You had restaurants, you had, well, not hotels, unfortunately, but places where you could sleep and, well, let's say, lie in a bed for a couple of hours or 1 hour if you were lucky enough.
Even for experienced negotiators, the COP21 feels like an alternative reality. One of them is Paul Watkinson, the chief climate negotiator for France.
It was the middle of winter. It was dark when we arrived in the morning. It was certainly dark by the time we left in the evening, if we got out in the evening. And during that time, apart from one little passage between part of the structure and another set of rooms, you never really went outside. At least I didn't.
Alexandre Ziegler.
It was never empty. Well, nights were as busy as days. And I can't remember of moments where you could be alone in these huge conference halls. It was always busy. And actually, when the conference rooms would empty by, let's say, maybe 4, 5 or 6 a.m., you had the tremendous activity of the secretariat trying to translate all these discussions into new texts. So you have dozens and dozens of people working from 5 to 8 to get this new text released. So honestly, I can't remember of any moment, night and day, being in a quiet environment or being alone or feeling lonely. It was always full of discussions and energy.
Of this global chess game, there is one constant during COP21, little to no sleep.
You have to imagine that we actually lived there days and nights during 2 weeks. First week, you sometimes could get back home and grab something like 4 or 5 hours of sleep every night, which was a real luxury. But the second week, we spent it 24 hours a day on the premises. I was fortunate enough to be in the presidency's offices, so we had a small collective place where we could lie down for, yes, 1 hour, 2 hours. But I really did spend the last 5 to 7 days at Le Bourget, in the conference center, without probably seeing one single minute the sky and natural light. So it was like living in a huge submarine where you could sleep sometimes, eat sometimes, and work a lot during days and days without getting back to the natural light.
Outside, civil society is also mobilizing.
Actually, during the COP21, we didn't sleep much, but not because of eco-anxiety, but because we were just doing so many actions that we didn't have time to sleep.
We are unstoppable. Another world is possible. COP21 is Pauline Boyer's first big climate event. She just joined Alternatiba, an NGO which organizes mobilizations and civil disobedience actions during the negotiations. They demand an ambitious climate agreement.
2 weeks before the COP21, we installed our headquarters, if I can say, in Île-Saint-Denis, in a big sport place. We were 200 people and we had like 200 camp beds. I think I slept 3 hours per night with 200 people around me who also didn't sleep so much. It was really an exciting moment. It's like a mix of despair feeling and also hope.
The chessboard is set and players are ready to move their first piece.
Tactic 1. Not repeating the mistakes of the past.
14 of the 15 warmest years on record have occurred since the year 2000. And 2015 is on pace to be the warmest year of all. No nation, large or small, wealthy or poor, is immune to what this means.
Like U.S. President Obama says, leaders cannot ignore the reality of global warming anymore, nor the fact that previous COPs have failed in properly addressing the issue of climate change.
Actually, on a daily basis, we were feeling this pressure from the world public opinion.
Alexandre Ziegler.
It was really a very special time in 2015. You had these climate marches all over the world. I think there was a dynamic that had been launched and the conviction that had been forged that actually there was no choice and that somebody has to be made, which was not at all the case 6 or 7 years before. So the pressure was so huge on us that we had no option but to succeed.
For months, France seized every opportunity to contrast its handling of COP21 with the ill-fated 2009 summit in Copenhagen. COP15 in Copenhagen fell horribly short of expectations. Ambitions ran low, and world leaders failed to secure a legally binding agreement.
The big difference between Le Bourget and Copenhagen was this decision we had made very early to convene the head of states at the beginning of the discussion and not at the end. And it had a very, very strong impact on the negotiation teams because they actually felt empowered. When your leaders are coming at the end, you put everything into brackets. You don't take the risk.
Side note, diplomats use brackets during negotiations when they haven't agreed on something yet. Sometimes just agreeing on the right adjective is tough. Example, adequate, sufficient, or efficient, which is better?
You say, well, probably at the end of the day, Obama will meet with Hollande and with Merkel and with Xi Jinping and find a solution. So I will protect my interest and keep the brackets in and the big ones will find the solution. There it was not possible. It had been made very, very clear that the leaders had given us a mandate at the beginning of the conference, but that they will not come back at the end. It was a bet, but it turned out to be pretty effective because even the smallest delegation, they did feel empowered and they were working in good faith because they knew that at the end of the day, they were the only one steering the wheel of the conference and not the big ones who would come at the end and solve everything.
Tactic two, want a global agreement? Choose exhausting democracy.
Turns out, the secret to successful negotiation is a methodology called Indaba. The term refers to a gathering of Zulu and Xhosa people of southern Africa. Leaders get together to attempt to find common ground on a problem that affects them all. The most important thing is, everybody gets a chance to speak.
So this Indaba was actually the main methodology for negotiation during the last 4 to 5 days. Long meetings with everybody. Usually that would last for the whole night. We are starting the Indaba at around 5-6 in the evening, and it would end up by 5-6 in the morning. And I remember myself, I must say I was not convinced when we started this process because it was so tiring. If we had not gone through this process, we would never have succeeded. It's not like a referendum or a vote. At the end of the day, we were 196. And you had to get 196 parties approving the final text. If one single hand had been raised the very last day, the whole of the 2 years process and these 15 days monster negotiations would have collapsed.
Tactic three, know when to stop and when to carry on.
At some point, the sheer physical exhaustion also starts to take over.
Paul Watkinson, chief negotiator of the French delegation.
Sometimes the meetings do run on until 2 in the morning. The fact is, by that stage, a lot of people are a lot less effective in picking up, in particular, the nuances of what people are saying. And if you're trying to get people to agree to something, capturing nuances is actually really important. Because in a negotiation, people rarely give everything, you know, totally open, but they send signals. When most people in the room are so tired, they don't even see and recognize those signals anymore. Sometimes you need an extra night because you lost the opportunity to get there.
But in some cases, stopping isn't an option. And delegates knew they had to carry on.
Sometimes it is the fact that you just want to use that tiredness, though. that exhaustion to reach a stage of, you know, we've gone this far, we must go that bit further. We're all looking for this outcome. And therefore, you know, nobody wants to stop and say, sorry, we can't finish this. I mean, in the last few nights of that conference, we had a room off the delegate meeting area. We laid out with a number of beds so that we could go and rest during the day if we were really tired. We didn't intend people to sleep there at night, but I spent the last three nights, I think, sleeping there. It wasn't a very good way to get rested or to get a sense of carrying on.
The game thickens.
Alexandre Ziegler.
2 days before the end of the conference, we were confronted with some kind of monster text of 500 pages with 200 brackets per page, because everybody had added something and nobody could really see where it was going. So it was a lot of individual negotiation, sometimes on a coffee shop table, sometimes on seats we would find in an empty conference room. Well, everybody we could find a seat and meet with, we would sit and discuss maybe half an hour, maybe 1 hour, maybe 2 hours, and try and find a solution to remove brackets. That was the most important task of the day. It doesn't sound like poetry, but that's the reality of a diplomatic job. Is do everything you can to remove brackets.
Paul Watkinson.
We had a whole series of questions to overcome in the Paris Agreement. Many of them turned around what we call differentiation, the way in which different parties and groups of parties are treated between developed countries and developing countries in particular. And that went back to the UN Climate Convention adopted in 1992, which had listed 30-odd developed countries in Annex 1, and others were non-Annex 1 and developing countries.
The Paris Conference should reject the narrow-minded mentality of the zero-sum game and call on all countries, the developed countries in particular, to assume more shared responsibility for win-win outcomes.
So we look to the developed countries to mobilize $100 billion annually by 2020 for mitigation and adaption in the developing countries.
So China was a developing country, India is a developing country, South Korea is a developing country. And the world has changed quite a lot between 1992 and 2015, and even more so in the past few years. And obviously there were countries in the developing country side who did not want to change that, and a strong push from many developed countries to move beyond that division. So that rigid differentiation and moving beyond it was one of the fundamental challenges of the negotiations in Paris.
Blunder. 4 letters that almost killed the Paris Agreement.
Just like chess masters, diplomats can make wrong moves. The secretariat worked day and night on their computers. Their job is to type up the agreement proposal based on what people said in the Indaba meetings. Like everybody else, they're tired. And well, typos happen. And one of them almost derails the whole conference.
We had a big challenge at the very end of a conference where we said that developed countries shall continue to take the lead, and that shall was a mistake. It should have been should, because that was a language which had been in the convention before. Shall created a new commitment for developed countries in terms of their mitigation actions, their actions to reduce emissions, which went beyond what they already had.
Only 4 letters separate shall from should, but in this context, it might as well have been an entire universe. A simple typo that places the Paris Agreement on the brink of checkmate and collapse.
It would have made the agreement totally impossible for the United States to ratify. You know, obviously, everybody had been trying to make a deal that everybody could come on board, and losing the US even before Trump came along would have been a major failing of the Paris Agreement. None of us actually have a good answer to what happened. Part of it may simply come back to our earlier conversation. We were all just too tired to read the thing properly. I got a few hours sleep after we finished the drafting. I came back to it with slightly fresh eyes around about 6 o'clock in the morning and worked through a paper copy, but it just didn't jump out at me. I then went and talked to various groups of parties to explain what was in the text, and somehow or other, none of us picked up that we'd made a mistake in that version of the text overnight. And I think it does illustrate one of the challenges of negotiating under such conditions, in that you're trying to make extremely fine legal judgments, and yet we're doing the proofreading and checking it when we're all in a condition of severe exhaustion and reaching the limits of our ability to put words together.
To solve the issue and save the Paris Agreement, the COP presidency has to convince all players that the shall or should debacle is a genuine mistake. Only a few hours remain before the closing of the conference. Time is running out.
It was obvious that it was a mistake. It wasn't what was intended, but it's what had been put in the draft document and sent out on the website to all parties. It was therefore the document which was on the table for the final plenary, which was meant to adopt the decision. And so you can't at that stage simply take it off the table and say, sorry, here's another document, you didn't see that one. The end result was basically the Chinese said, no, we recognize it's a mistake, it can go forward. And with that sort of done, it was generally accepted that it would be amended. And when we came to the adoption in the early evening, the secretariat simply read out a number of errors which had been introduced into the text by mistake, including the shall turning to should. It gave a little drama to the final hours, and maybe that was something which is always written about afterwards.
A surprising player, the Pope.
UN climate conferences require consensus. Absolutely everyone needs to agree for an agreement to be adopted. But in the final hours of COP21, one player is being difficult.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
And it takes a holy intervention to solve the issue. Alexandre Ziegler.
It was a country in Latin America, I can't say more, but I called the ambassador and told him, hey, you know, we're blocked. There's no way we can convince either the minister or the chief negotiator that they should remove this bracket or agree on this compromise. So what do you think we can do? And he just thought about it for a minute and said, I think I know what I should do. I should call the nonce, so the ambassador of the Vatican. And the nuns will probably call the president's wife because they are very close friends. And I'm pretty sure that the president's wife will convince his husband. And that's the way we solved it. And this ambassador probably did save the agreement because he just knew that the one who could convince the president to pick up the phone and tell to his chief negotiator, it's all right, you can agree on that, was going through the nonce and through the president's wife. And that's also, in a way, the clear demonstration that in such a conference, of course, what is going on at Le Bourget and what is going on during the last 15 days of a 2 years process is absolutely crucial. But if you don't have ambassadors all across the world that are aware and involved in the negotiation, and if you don't have a global network, actually, that is capable of reaching the right people at the right moment in the capital of a small country in Latin America, you can derail a global machinery like the Paris Agreement.
All it takes is a bit of research, and you'll find out that the said country is actually Nicaragua. Paul Watkinson.
The other question is whether a country wants to be the country which blocks an international deal of this sort. And there are many who will keep their objections until the last minute, but very few countries want to be seen as the one who holds up an international agreement on climate change. The key thing is to adjust the content so that it can be acceptable, rather than to try and block it entirely.
But once the COP21 handles typos and obstacles, the final countdown begins.
checkmate. The adoption of the Paris Agreement.
Everybody wants perfection. We reach a stage when you cannot seek perfection at the end of a conference. You're looking for a deal in which it's going to work, it's effective, it's sufficient for what we're trying to do.
I was on stage, I was sitting behind ministers and head of states.
Alexandre Ziegler practically has a front seat during the adoption of the Paris Agreement. He's even on the official photos.
When I look at these photos, I feel horrified because I look so tired and exhausted, and it's like looking at another person, actually. But we had not been sleeping for the past 5 nights. It was just like another dimension. The president raised his little green hammer and just asked to the audience, is there any objection to the adoption of this agreement? And we were all fearing that a hand or two or three would raise and that everything would collapse in front of the world's cameras and the head of states. And well, even though we had negotiated and we had an agreement and we had commitments from all the parties, there was always this fear that somebody would have received a phone call from his president and say, hey, no, well, I made up my mind, you can't vote. Then if one hand had raised, actually, at that moment, it was the end, because there was no way we could resume our negotiations. And then I don't think we would have had a chance to adopt such an agreement in the future. So a lot of tension. And this minute probably lasted like one century in our mind.
La salle. Je vois que la réaction est positive. Je n'entends pas d'objection. L'accord de Paris pour le climat est accepté.
And then there was a final clap, and it was adopted, and we all raised and hugged and congratulated. And it was maybe like a kid at Christmas, but it was not a diplomatic negotiation anymore. It was a pure moment of joy.
On the NGO side, the atmosphere is quite different.
I was disappointed.
Pauline Boyer.
The NDC, the Nationally Determined Contributions, from all states were not enough to achieve a trajectory of 1.5 degree by the end of the century. So it means that if we add all the NDCs, we headed up to 3 degrees, which is like a chaos, which means entire territories that will not be livable. And this is why we decided to symbolically declare the state of climate emergency. So we knew that governments didn't really want to take action. The powerful countries did not enough to get to this agreement we needed, actually.
After the game, back to reality.
After the COP21, it was a bittersweet feeling that we did all what we could at this moment to raise attention. And after all those nights awake, we just needed to sleep and to process everything, to realize what it meant. I think at this time we were really avant-gardist, because honestly, my parents and my family was like, what are you doing? You left a job and you're just like coordinating civil disobedience actions. You have like police identity controls, and what the hell are you doing? And now they won't be saying that today.
Alexandre Ziegler.
Of course, we did celebrate. So we got back to our offices, and we opened champagne, and everybody was so happy. And we did celebrate with the team maybe 2 hours. And then I was supposed to drive back to Paris to get back to my family. And well, I realized that I couldn't drive back. I was just too exhausted. And I remember my youngest daughter has a gym competition on the following day, on the Sunday morning in Paris. And I say to my wife, I really have to go to bed. My hotel room is just 1 kilometer away. And if I drive back, I'm just going to kill myself. So I fall asleep at 7 or 8, and I had only one fear, is that I would not wake up on time to be at 10 o'clock in Paris for my daughter's competition. And I made it, and that was quite an achievement too, as important as the agreement itself. And yeah, at 10 o'clock I was there. And well, it was a Sunday in December, a bit rainy, but with the Christmas lighting all across the city, and it was like getting back to life or to reality.
Paul Watkinson.
In terms of the actual physical experience of being in Le Bourget, I probably do everything I can to forget about it, but I think about the results and particularly about what we can do with it, because the whole point of having an agreement is not to have a piece of paper that says Paris Agreement. It's to influence the policies which governments are taking. It's to change the decisions on investment in energy systems, in industry, in infrastructure. It's about building the resilience we need to deal with the impacts of climate change, which just keep getting worse. So the Paris Agreement did not solve climate change. It gives us a tool that we can use as we move forward in working together and in building the national policies, in involving other actors, non-state actors. It's all about, in the end, cooperation and collaboration, because that's where the real strengthening is going to take place. And so having built that up, having gone through that, it was worth it to feel exhausted and tired and generally worn out for several weeks afterwards as you try to get some energy back and hope to get back to at least a reasonable level of intellectual functioning by the start of the next year. So yes, it was draining, but the result made it worth it.
It takes listening to the people who worked tirelessly during the COP21 to understand that it was a political game well played. COP21 made a history. It was the first time countries around the world agreed to act together on climate change. But according to a recent United Nations report, there's now less than a 14% chance of reaching the 1.5 degree target set out in the Paris Agreement. Going back to Le Bourget today shows how quickly the world moved on from COP21. There's nothing left from the thousands of people who met and managed to agree on the Paris Agreement. Back to the status quo, Le Bourget remains famous for its airport and for hosting one of the biggest aviation shows in the world. A far cry from what it represented for our planet's future just 8 years ago. This episode was produced by Morgana Nex, Luca Matteucci, and Aurore Laborie. Our editor-in-chief was Lauren Bess. Thank you to all who participated in this project. Check out other episodes of The Night I Didn't Sleep on Sciences Po's website and on all other platforms.